Great. Good morning. Welcome, everyone, ladies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, all protocols observed, as they say in Nigeria. Welcome to the first annual CAF LSE conference on the Global South. We are pleased to have you here today, and we're pleased to unpack what we hope will be an exciting event, an event that brings together academics, scholars, policymakers, practitioners. So the right kind of mix, we think, that reflects the skill set that we represent here at the LSE. We have in good northern efficiency. We have a program in front of you. We're going to alter it slightly to accommodate situations. The first is to ask that our distinguished guest, President Enrique Garcia, to speak to take the podium. As you know, President Garcia heads up the CAF and has done so since 1991. He was Bolivia's Minister of Planning and Coordination in the period before that, has occupied senior positions in the banking world and the Inter-American Development Bank for 17 years, acted as Bolivia's governor of the World Bank, and indeed holds a range of posts and associations. I will not go through all of them in detail because it would take it's a testimonial, it would take some time. But in any case, may I welcome President Garcia to the podium.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's indeed a great honor and pleasure to be here in London, and particularly to open this seminar, this conference, which we believe is a very, very important conference. I would like to make a clarification because, you know, when you kindly mentioned my background, you mentioned that I'm in CAF since 1991. It's a fact. But just to clarify, I have been reelected, but without changing the constitution. That's a very, very important matter, because today there's a new trend, you know, that when you're in power, you change the constitution. And I learned all these things from the other Enrique, the good Enrique, you know, Enrique Iglesias, the good one, so who's going to be our keynote speaker this morning. I would like to emphasize the fact that why are we here? CAF, beyond being a multilateral development bank, which started as a small institution from the Andean region, in the last 15, 20 years, it has transformed itself in a regional institution. And there is one element that I would like to emphasize. We happen to be the only regional multilateral bank, I think, in the world, which is owned, in essence, by emerging countries. Because we have 18 member countries today, and out of those, there are only two countries that are not from the Latin America and Caribbean region, Spain and Portugal, which together only hold about 3% of the CAF. So this is a very, very peculiar thing. So what CAF represents, I think, is it shows that if you have the right type of attitude and you get the commitment of member countries, it is possible to have an integrated approach to issues. And in fact, today, the commercial will end here, we represent basically in terms of financing about one-third of the total multilateral financing in Latin America, if you compare to the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, which in 25 years ago, we represent about 1%. And this is fact. But beyond the financing of projects, programs, trade, public and private sector, we have put a lot of emphasis in the intellectual side. Because I think that one of the crucial elements in a development bank is precisely to provide knowledge. And to do that, you cannot do it by yourself. You have to have links with universities, with think tanks, with academics. And precisely, I'm very pleased that in the last 2 years, we have built up a very strong relationship with, in the last 5 years, I would say, many universities, think tanks around the world. And I'm particularly happy about this one, because I think this is a great university which delves into the issues of development in a very open way, without a partial ideological tendency, but trying to accept the difference that do exist. And precisely, CAF is that. We work very well in the region with different ideologies, different concepts, trying to serve the countries the best possible way and trying to bring them as input new ideas, new elements to try to solve the issues of development. And another thing that is very, very interesting, normally when you have these conferences, and there are so many, you talk about Latin America or about Asia in the world. In this case, we are talking about Latin America, but we are putting Latin America in a global context. And that's why we have this South relationship. And that's why we are very pleased, you will see in the different panels and the excellent speakers, high-level speakers that we have, are not only from Latin America or UK, but are speakers that come from Asia, from Africa, from different parts of the world. And this is the new reality, a reality in which if Latin America wants to be a successful region in the future, it has to look at the world. And if the Latin America wants the world to look at Latin America, it has to think in the world. And this South-South relationship in the new environment is a very crucial one. So again, I want to thank very much the high-level speakers and all of you. And I'm sure that we are going to have a very distinguished set of panels and that we will learn a lot and not learn just as, you know, background in theory, but to try to apply some of the ideas that will come in this magnificent day for the future of the region. So thank you very much. And again, thank you to LSC for opening this opportunity for CAF and for Latin America. Thank you very much.
Now, if I may call upon our own director, Craig Calhoun, to speak. He's a fairly new appointee and came from the United States from the Social Science Research Council, New York University, and has quite a distinguished record as a public intellectual. May I ask Craig to take the podium?
Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Enrique, for the previous remarks, but even more for the chance to be here. This is a wonderful occasion, and it's a wonderful cooperation. I would like to thank our colleagues in this, the CAF, but also mention that the partnership between the LSC and the CAF that makes this discussion possible actually fits very much with the theme and the issues of the discussion. And it reveals the importance of looking at globalization as something that happens in particular places, so that we look at particular places in the world, but we also look at the issues of what's happening globally from particular places. Globalization is not simply a process in which the same thing happens everywhere in the same way. It is a process in which what goes on in different countries is affected by what goes on elsewhere. The opportunities are shaped. There are constraints. There is competition. But all of this is a matter of a differentiated process, but an integrated process. And in this sense, we're very grateful to the CAF for the opportunity to look at globalization this way during this conference. That is, to look at phenomena that are linking countries around the world into a common situation, but are doing it in ways that do not erase national or regional differences, that force us to confront differences of perspective, but invite us to also discover commonalities and ways in which we can learn from each other in a variety of different settings. I think this is important for the LSE. I'm delighted that it's the opinion of Enrique and his colleagues that it's important for the CAF, because I think it is a pivotal matter for the future of global policy and also global social science. Now, I'm not going to belabor the point at any length today, because I probably know less about this than most of the speakers that you're going to hear from. It's a measure of the success of this early partnership that we have an extraordinary lineup today. And it's really a chance for each of us to learn something from some of the people who have the most insight into these interconnected processes that are shaping the world that we live in, the economic situations we face, but also the connections of economic matters to politics, culture, and other issues. So, lastly, may I thank all of you for joining us, because I know that we will learn the questions asked and the discussion, as well as the speeches today. Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you, Chris. Thank all of you.
And I would thank you very much. And I would like to invite Enrique Iglesias, Ibero-American Secretary General, to give us the keynote address. He was previously the president of the Inter-American Development Bank, has had many significant posts, both in academia and in policymaking. Again, bringing together all those different streams, which we hope to be a part of this conference and the kind of work we do generally here at the LSE. Just to flag a few, founding member of Third World Forum, Secretary General in the UN Conference on New and Renewable Energy, and, of course, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Uruguay. I ask Dr. Iglesias, please, to take the stand.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the invitation. I want to especially give my special thanks to Enrique the rich, I am Enrique the poor, for his initiative to hold this sort of meetings. I think CAF is doing a wonderful job in opening this sort of dialogues from the United States, Latin America, Europe, Asia. This is a unique institution doing this, and I am very, very happy to congratulate him and his colleagues for this special opportunity open to Latin America and to other people of all regions working in the economic and social field. So this is something that I like very much to highlight today. But also very happy because I have been dealing through my long, long years of life and many times with the London School of Economics. I have a big appreciation for what this institution is doing. I had to remember my very good friend, Darren Dorf, who used to be a good friend with whom we worked when I was in IDB. And I think, therefore, for this initiative, we are really with a privileged situation and a privileged contribution of this institution. Well, the name of this conversation today has to do with the rise of the South. If this conference or lecture would have taken place 30 years ago, we have called it the Third World, the rise of the Third World. Maybe 15 years later, the rise of the developing countries. But now I'm very happy to speak of the rise of the South. Yes, it's a very indicative way of how we are upgrading the nomination of what we used to call traditionally developing countries. Indeed, we have an impressive transformation of the South taking place, unprecedented in many ways. The UNDP used to say that the rise of the South is unprecedented in speed and in scale. Never in history so many people change so dramatically and so fast. That is a beautiful definition of the moment in which we are living, which is leading to lift millions of people from poverty and to welcome also millions of people into what I call in general the middle class. Perhaps Latin America, my region, is a very good example of that. How we are integrating into the world economy, how we are making real efforts in terms of education, and we are making also gains in the area of embajador, encantado tenerlo aquí. The rising of the South is opening also very impressive opportunities to the North. And for all of us who are lived in recent years, the major crisis of 2008, we can see how the South is becoming a major engine that is supplementing or making their role in keeping afloat the situation of the world economy through trade, through possibilities of investment for the North, for opportunities of exchange in technology, of new modern activities and expansion of services, etc. So if there has been a good case to show how the transformation of the South is also becoming a major engine of opportunities and growth. For the North, this is the one. Is this enough? Probably not. Much more could be done. But so far, it is difficult to imagine now growth in the North without taking into account also the chances and the opportunities offered by the development of the South. There are figures which are really very striking. Between 1980 and 2010, the GNP, the participation of South in the GNP, world GNP moved from 33 to 45%, in trade moved from 25 to 47%, and South to South from 8 to 20%. These are three indicative figures, and probably the most striking is that when Millennium Development Goals were fixed, the idea was that we had to achieve a reduction of poverty to 50% from 1990 to 2015. But in 2010, poverty went down from 43 to 22%. That means that 5 years earlier, this target was achieved in the world today. We mentioned many other indexes like the expansion of internet, mobile phones, etc. Everywhere there are movements to modernization taking place in certain areas of the southern societies, but taking place in a quick and impressive way. Now, what it is also relevant is to show how the South makes more contributions to global economic growth than developed countries. This is 2/3 of growth today comes from developing countries, from the so-called southern countries. And in 2007, for instance, 85 countries of the so-called South had bigger growth rate than the countries of the OECD. And this index to me was also very striking. By 2020, China, India, and Brazil together, the output of these three countries, will bypass US, Germany, UK, France, Italy, and Korea together. This is really quite a show when we look to this sort of figure altogether. In the case of trade, it's really where you can see an expansion, and this has to do a lot with the introduction of China into the trade, particularly in the creation of new opportunities for three major areas in which particularly Latin America and Africa are particularly endowed. This is the case of food, the case of metals, and the case of energy. And since China became a major, I always used to say that China put a second floor to the world economy. And in that second floor, for the first time, China, Latin America, and Africa had a very special situation. They are providing these commodities in which China is very thirsty. But also interesting to notice that 2/3 of the world reserves now are in the hands of southern countries. of which China alone has three trillion, and three quarters of the sovereign funds in the world also belong to the developing countries. So, in a way, we are moving, and it's very common to say that the shifting of manufacture is now moving to Asia, moving to China. China is being called the factory of the world. So these are things which, for my generation, this almost inimaginable 15, 20, or 30 years ago. But this is a reality, a good reality. I would say that also there are technological improvements. And I remember, I remember here Latin America. Latin America is doing a real agricultural revolution of big productivity in Brazil, in Argentina, in Uruguay, Colombia. I mean, there are a big impact, and it's also creating new opportunities in technological breakthroughs in oil drilled from the sea, which is the case of Brazil, or technological breakthroughs in the field of biotechnology, as the case of Cuba. So there are spots of improvement which are also very impressive. And it's interesting to remember that 40% of world researchers are in Asia. So that is the potential in which we are talking about. Now, let me mention also as an important point the contribution that is taking place as a result of this transformation of the South. And in this moment, there are already 40 developing countries which are improving in social gains more than the average expected. 40 countries are beyond the targets expected. And countries, in a way, profit by commodities to make real social change, in the case of Latin America. In Latin America, because of the situation in the last 10 years, there have been dramatic social change, in the case of Brazil, taking out of poverty millions of people. And the whole Latin America is 80 million people came out of poverty in the last 10 years, and 50 million people were introduced into the middle class. So this is the type of transformation which is really mobilizing, including new paradigms. I must say, for instance, that one way to deal with poverty in the case of Latin America has been the conditional transfer of resources to the poor people who are really improving the quality of life of millions of people, Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, etc. So, I mean, the situation is not only reduced to figures in economic achievement, but it's also very relevant in the area of social improvement. Now, is this the end of the history? Are we really in the era of Latin America or in the era of Africa? I would be very cautious to arrive to get to that conclusion. I think we still have big pending problems, both at the level of the countries and at the level of the world as a whole. There are risks of returning to poverty, the risks of $1.5 billion still in poverty, and also the risks of environmental degradation, the risks of climate change. So in a way, the situation has to be taken carefully, but in the following way. The present change in the pattern of economic developing in the world with the rise of the South is giving a tremendous opportunity for the South itself, and also giving a tremendous opportunity for the economy of the whole world. But many things have to be done, both at the national level and both at the world level. Let me mention only very briefly the two levels looking to the future. I think that there are many things has to be done in the countries, and we cannot enter in all of them, but if you ask me what are the major areas in which we should concentrate efforts in the years to come to make these new changes a real instrument of permanent growth and sustained social improvement, I will mention three. I will mention the need of macroeconomic stability. I will mention the case of educational revolution and productivity revolution. These three things, to me, should be carefully architectured to improve those present trends into some type of permanent development program toward the future. When I speak about macroeconomic stability, we are learning the lessons of the past. Nowadays, of course, the developed countries are very much worried about low rate of growth, high rate of unemployment, accumulation of debt. that's okay. But in our case, we still have to take care of our own rate of growth, the potential risks of inflation, the situation of low quality of employment, to mention some of those cases. So something has to be done to preserve a minimum quality of macroeconomic situation that would permit to balance the different factors in our economic equations. And I think this has been, we had many lessons, 30 years of lessons in Latin America, learning of inflation and crisis of all kinds. We are a laboratory of experiences, so respect for macroeconomic stability for me is a must. It's the must, that is the lessons of history in the last decades in the region as a whole. The second question is the so-called revolution, educational revolution. I admire what the Asian countries have done in that respect, making of education a major instrument of change as a commitment of the state, as a commitment of the political leaders, but also as a commitment of the families. We need in Latin America to introduce this of revolution in education as a major objective in the years to come. When you look at the PISA evaluations of the OECD, one really becomes very sad. My own country, Uruguay, has had it for years a major point in education. Today is one of the last in the picture of PISA. So something has been wrong in recent years to forget that only education is the real instrument of change in the years to come. And we need to, the quality of education, the quality of our teachers, the permanence in the school, and also a commitment of society and a commitment of the family as part of the control of the situation for the future. In the third area of my internal fronts is a revolution in productivity. We need a bigger introduction. We know that the economic development will become very much dependent on knowledge. And of this knowledge, we need technology, we need innovation, we need infrastructure. And I think this is very important to improve the allocation of resources, to improve the movement of low to high levels of productivity in our labor force. And this is also a third area in which we must put emphasis. Now, what we need on the other front, in the international arena, and I think this is the area in which I would like to point some specific concern that I have. I think that we must recognize that the crisis of the 2008 and 2009 has not been a typical crisis we had in the last 30, 40 years. It's a much deeper crisis. I think we are confronted to a real change in the world economy, and it is still far from having its finalization. I think we are in the process of continuous change, and what we know is that we are not going to go back to what we started. We are going to go into a new model of economic growth based basically in knowledge. We are going to a new society with the new presence of strong middle classes. And we are entering into a new international set of relations because we are observing the biggest transfer of power in history from west to south and east. And this is something which will imply a tremendous reaccommodation of governance of the world if we really want to manage the opportunities of this transfer of power. Well, if we have to choose some areas of specific concern, I will mention other three only. And I will mention trade in the first place. I will mention the participation of developing countries in the change of value, in particular in the industrial sector. And I will mention the participation of the South in the governance of the world. Speaking of the first line, in the first of trade, we are all been pushing in Latin America particularly for the opening of trade. The starting of the Uruguay Round in 1986 and the creation of WTO has been a major achievement, strongly demanded by developing countries and strongly demanded by the South. Well, I think that this is not yet clear. I hope that we can retain the major objectives of WTO. The recent Bali meeting was very successful in a way, but we are still far from having a real perspective toward the future. I am a little bit concerned that the tendencies to fragmentation are still there. The creation of these new mega treaties in the northern part of the Atlantic, or the creation of the mega treaty in the area of the Pacific, can be make important contributions, provided we are not abandoned what have been the major rules fixed in the WTO creation. For Latin America, for developing countries, that would be a really backward movement if this takes place. So the first situation is that if we want to preserve the engine of growth that Southern Caribbean can provide to the world through trade, we must try to preserve also the basic organization in which we put effort, strong political effort, in many years of work through the creation of a solid and open trade world economy. Second area is the situation of the participation in the change of value in the countries of the South. You see, I have been very impressed also in the Japanese experience, when Japan, at the beginning of the expansion of their economy and their trade possibilities, they involved a series of countries in the Asian area to become partners in the exports of their common products to the whole of the world. This is not the case that's taking place today. I think that looking to the future, I think that the developing countries need to have the possibilities of active participation in the chains of value, not only within themselves, which is already an objective, but also with other developing countries and with other developed countries. I see that in Mexico and the United States. But do I see that in the case of China and Latin America? Not yet. So what I mean by opening the door to have more participation in the chains of value to developing countries, we are thinking is the only way in which really the expansion of trade and can make a real contribution not only to develop in the north but also to develop in the south. And finally, the final point is the whole question of participation in global governance. I think the world has to revise global governance. We are starting to do something in the G20. I must tell you, I'm not very happy with the G20, at least with the G20 of the 2008. When for the first time they reacted going to Washington to see what can be done. My impression that the G20 is really is the beginning of something which is not yet proving its real efficiency in terms of commanding the real change that takes place, particularly in the financial side. But still, we are all clear that there is nothing that can be done in the world level trying to put order and discipline in economic policy without the participation of the South. And for this purpose, changes in the structure of the IMF or the World Bank or the reality is a basic point. So I think the governance should be open to recognize that we must move to a new world of possibilities in which these things can be achieved through active participation in different ways of today of the countries of the South. And I finish by saying I think these new changes are really very impressive in terms of what's going on. We are looking to a new world. I think there are major opportunities, but of course they require internal policies in developing countries and at the same time the reshaping of the world economic order in which that everybody can really make a case developing their own societies. Thank you very much.
We have time for questions if you'd like to pose some to Professor Iglesias. Please identify yourself and put your question clearly rather than a statement. I prefer it that way. As I say to my students, please don't all speak at once. Let me pose the first question, if I might, as I'm taking the advantage of the chair, which is you've distinguished between what I could call a South 1.0, the third world, and the South of today, a South 2.0. The process of transformation from one to the other, do you feel that is one that is more export-oriented, outward-looking versus the inward-looking policies of the past, of South 1.0? Do you feel that the structures and policies have been embedded, that, for instance, resource nationalism and other tendencies are not going to remake or reintroduce some of the issues which characterize economic problems which characterize the South of the past?
I think that there has been change clearly from the purely inward-looking policies of 40 years ago. And this is very much the case of Latin America, which is the area I know a little bit more. We are changing, but not in all countries at the speed that it is needed. I think the general movement is towards the direction of opening the economies. And I think that one lesson that we are learning is that regional integration can play a role facilitating the expansion of the economies into the world system. I believe that. I am a very strong defender of integration in Latin America. After 50 years, we cannot be very, very happy. I think it's a little bit frustrating when you see that in the last 50 years, only 19% of the trade in Latin America is done in the region. So I'm a strong believer that we need to work very much in expanding regional trade in an efficient manner, not to isolate Latin America, to make more stronger to participate in the world market. This is why I think the whole question of chain of the participation and the change of value is so important internally, in order to provoke growth and at the same time permitting the countries to participate more efficiently in the world competition. So I think we are in much more open tendency, but we need very much to strengthen the regional cooperation in order to facilitate that opening to the rest of the world. And we need, of the course, to make our internal policies viable. And this is something which probably will be the course of the future. Let me tell you that when you speak about the opening, there is a point which we must remember. In this moment in Latin America, we are more than 500 multilatinas enterprises. Enterprises who, within the present economic structures and regulations, they can target their policies in the region, expanding to the United States, expanding to China, expanding to Europe. This means that there is a spirit of opening in the market. But still, as I said, something must have been done in that direction.
My question is a very quick one. This scholars group, we have a difficulty with concepts and ideas. And I was wondering, when you talk about Latin America, I'm talking about Latin American plural. So I talk about many different dynamics going on in a particular part of the world. So you have different groupings in Latin America. You have different ideological nations in different countries. And my question is whether we can use Latin America as a useful analytical concept to understand what's going on in the global south.
Yo entendí bien qué es lo que.
¿Cómo?
Yes, we have ideological difference in the region, yeah. But I think in some cases we give more role to the state, in other cases more role to the market. But in both cases, market and state work, different participation, but in all of them there are market and government with different participation. There are more than one concept of integration also. You have countries, the case of ALBA has much more a kind of cooperation among the countries in different fronts, more than trade opening of the markets. In other countries, like the case of the Mercosur, we have a much more open economies trying to have even a common trade tariff as a part of the objectives of the association. In other cases, now we are opening, in the case of the Pacific, a new set of countries are opening the market towards stronger trends among themselves and with the Pacific. So there are different experiences. But I would tell you that we are also having an association which includes all the countries in the region, which is CELAC. CELAC is the beginning of, for the first time, of an important political association, which is badly needed. I think it's a good thing to have CELAC as a group of countries covering all areas, Caribbean and Latin American and Central American countries. And I hope that this can be give impulse to new areas of cooperation. But it's clear that there are differences in the way, particularly in the way in which the government participates in promoting economic programs in the region. This is probably the most different type of among themselves. But in general, I would say Latin America is moving toward that direction, and the creation of CELAC is one very good demonstration, which is the tendency toward the years to come.
I'm Professor Tao Tao Chen from Tsinghua University, mainland China. I do appreciate your presentation. I actually learned a lot. My question is towards China. You just mentioned that the role of the China, and then you also mentioned that from your generation, it's hard to imagine, like several decades ago, the world is looked like that. So actually, I know pretty much about the expectation of the world for China. But I really want to know from your experience, what is your biggest concern of rising China? Thank you.
I presume you are thinking of my concern as a Latin American. My concern in Latin America. In general, I think China is making a major partner of world development. I think whatever is taking place in your country will affect the world economy anywhere. Of course, we are looking very carefully the new drive in the strategy of development, look more to inward-looking development versus outward-looking development. This is very important for China. And I think in this moment, anything that happens in the rhythm and growth of your country will affect the rest of the world anywhere. Now, in the case of Latin America, particularly from Panama South, has in China a tremendous partner. In some countries, it's the first destiny of export, second destiny of export. It's becoming also major, a partner in the area of investment. It's still very low, still low compared to the total. We are expecting to have a more active Chinese presence in the area of investment. What I would like to see more is what I said in my presentation, is the possibility of look into this sort of participation of Latin American industries into chains of value in the structure of your own country. In other words, in the same manner that Thailandia, Philippines, Vietnam participated in the package of export of Japan, becoming partners in their chains of value, we would like to see China doing something like that. In a way, so far this is not the case. You are producing by yourselves, but I think we like to see, Latin America needs industrialization. We cannot remain only exporters of commodities. We need to have industry. We need to have, and in that respect, association with a country like yours, our biggest partner in terms of export, is vital. So what I would like to see more, perhaps, is something that requires some time. Your country, but this sort of what is the strategy of investment of your country is something, in my view, very important to look ahead in Latin America. This is probably the major concern that we can have now in a positive manner, but still a concern.
Hi, I'm Miles Kellerman, a graduate student of international relations at Oxford University. Mr. Iglesias, you mentioned the importance of regional integration. I was wondering if you think the CAF, as opposed to the IADB or World Bank, is in a better position to promote that integration because its shareholders are also its borrowers.
I think
Both. In the case of IDB has been working from early 60s in terms of supporting integration, has been a pioneer in terms of integration, as well as ISCAF later on to do in the same role. I think both institutions have to complement in that side. In previous to IDB, I must say the ECLA in 1959 started to move the creation of ALALC, was the first global integration process, free trade area, including Mexico and nine countries of South America. So all institutions, in a way or the other, have been dealing with integration efforts and becoming good partners of them, particularly in integration of infrastructure. CAF has made a pioneer work in Latin America. It's really the biggest, strongest investor in infrastructure, and infrastructure is really making integration. If we want to make integration, we have to support all efforts of infrastructure in a region which is badly needing integration in many fronts. And I think CAP is doing a wonderful job in that area. So everybody is working in the same line.
Perhaps if I might add, as Enrique mentioned, all these institutions are working with on the issues of integration. In fact, the IDB in the 60s, the first president there, Felipe Herrera, he called the IDB the Banco de la Integración, the high commitment. Now, in our case, regional integration has become a very fundamental pillar. Our expansion from just five countries to what we have today essentially is based on the strength that we put in our priorities to regional integration. And regional integration in a very pragmatic way, because, you know, there are many issues, as one of the speakers mentioned, in terms of the differences that exist in trade and other things in the region. But there are some common grounds. And, for instance, as Enrique mentioned, infrastructure is one of the issues in which no matter where you are in the ideological spectrum, there is a common denominator. And the other thing is that Enrique mentioned, and I think is crucial, if Latin America wants to be in the higher participation in the change of value, it has to go to productive transformation, which implies different production patterns that go beyond the traditional commodity-based commodities that are part of the success of Latin America in recent years. And to do that and be competitive, to attract my good friend from China, to, you know what we say in Beijing normally, to attract investment from China, going beyond petroleum, gas, and that, to other areas of value, you need to have a market in Latin America. And that's why integration becomes a crucial one. We cannot be happy in Latin America with just having trade that represents about 17-18% of GDP, compared to Asia, 47%, and Europe. So this is a great challenge, I would say.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm Chris Arnold from the University of Oxford. You mentioned that the rise of the South needs or calls for a new governance structure. So I was wondering first, could you elaborate on that a little bit more in specific terms? Because this seems to be quite a vague reform idea. And second, to which extent do we need reform of the governance structure? Do you see a change within existing institutions, so different voting rules, for example? Or do you think more about new forms of institutions or new institutions like initiatives by the BRICS or different groups of countries?
Look, it's vague, yes, because I don't have a definite picture of what has to be done. What I notice is that the basic facts from which we started in 1945, for instance, is creating the United Nations, are changing. The structure of power has changed a lot. in Africa, in Asia, everywhere. So in some way, this new political structure has to be reflected in the governance of the United Nations, particularly the Security Council. Something has to be done. It's not an easy thing to do, but I think that clearly there is an objective to go. Probably it's also a much more effective way to manage the financial institutions. I don't think the economic strength of the South is well reflected in the structure of governance of the IMF and the World Bank. So in all these cases, something has to be done to update the presence of the power of the world of today into the governing institutions of this, the governance of these institutions. But I think also that there are many movements ahead of us. We have to be dealt. For instance, when the G20 was organized in 2008, everybody was expecting that something would have to be done in the financial sector. Very little. Has been something done, and I think we have had the Basel agreements and the law in the United States. I don't mean that nothing has been done, but I think that something has to be done. And it seems to me that since Washington, following Washington, very little thing has been done in terms of the financial sector compared to what is needed, in my view. I mean, we have a financial, in this moment, financial assets which are four times the GDP of the world. Do we need that? Maybe, but I'm not convinced. So I think these sort of reflections, this financial structure is one of the real issues that has to be tackled in the world of today, of tomorrow. The real issue, because otherwise their strengths are so big that we may be convinced of that question that they are too big to fail. So this is not... These are not simple, the simple questions, and I think these definitions are difficult to solve, but must be taken with the full participation of the southern countries. We have a lot to do. I spoke about the participation in reserves. 2/3 of reserves now in the world are in the hands of the South. So I think my impression is that the whole structure created in 1945, the United Nations, the Bretton Woods institutions, the Court of Justice, all these were the basic governance structures that stem from the previous world, and particularly were, in a way, architecture by the West, and in English. So I think this is the reality. So that reality of 1945 has changed dramatically. So the world of the future, we have to look carefully, peacefully, and particularly in a consultative manner, because we must accept that we are now confronted with new areas, with different values, with different concepts that must be in some way coordinated and balanced to have a peaceful world of tomorrow. This is a very difficult task. What reform, I don't know. But this, what I know is that it must be done with everybody at the table and recognizing that we must confront the different challenges. I mentioned the financial challenge, the climate change challenge, and the environmental challenges of the planet. These things require a common view, and we must understand that in the world of today, not everybody agrees with the same thing, the same approaches. So what I'm saying is that when we are looking to the changes in the change of power in the world, we are now confronted not only with economic power, we are confronted with different values on the table, and combination and coordination to confront those values with a minimum set of agreements to preserve peaceful agreements in the world is something which is a task in which we must work together. And these, to me, are the real challenges ahead. This is why when you ask me what to do, I don't know. What I know is that the challenges are very big. They are not only economic problems, there are all value issues at stake and must be coordinated in order to have a world in peace, but giving the opportunities of reflect in our changes the real power of the world of today.
I think that's a wonderful place to close from, the notion of challenges facing us, not to be able to summarize everything that was said, but the themes that I see emerging already speak to the kinds of concerns that this conference will be addressing later. The role of Latin America within this globalizing structure, the institutions of global governance, the economic opportunities and challenges facing the region as an actor, all of these things are brought out in greater detail, we hope, in the coming panels. So thank you very much, and we have a 15-minute coffee break.